It's high on a mountain, the warm winds are blowing, and where the winds are blowing to, there ain't no way of knowing. The mountain grass is short, it's dry and close to burning, crying out for water as the season's turning. Sweet smell of the pines, tall western cedar, drifting on the wind through the mountains like a river.
Hello, this is Ayana Young, and I welcome you to Unlearn and Rewild, where we explore radical ideas relating to earth renewal. As a follow-up to our recent show about restoration agriculture with Mark Shepherd, today we're speaking with Courtney White, the author of Grass, Soil, Hope, about carbon ranching and the new agrarian movement. He is a former archaeologist and environmental activist, and he co-founded the Kivira Coalition in 1997, a nonprofit dedicated to building bridges between ranchers, conservationists, public land managers, scientists, and others around the idea of land health. Today, his work with Kivira concentrates on building economic and ecological resilience on working landscapes. Hello, Courtney. It's so nice to have you with us today.
Thank you for having me on the show.
So carbon sequestration and global topsoil loss are central themes in the climate change debate, and you're helping to join those dots. But now everyone knows what carbon is, but may have trouble explaining what carbon is. The way we usually hear about it is synonymous with the problem. So what is carbon really? Where is it found, or where isn't it found? And is it simply a problem as newscasters and politicians speak of it?
That's a great question. Everywhere you turn, carbon is the bad guy. It's the problem. It's to be defeated. There's a war on carbon. There's too much carbon pollution. When I started looking into it, I thought, you know, wait a minute. Carbon is essential to life. You know, it's number six on the periodic chart of the elements. It's in all organic life forms. It's in our food. It's in the soil. It's in animals. And how could an element that's so essential to life be the bad guy? And so once I started looking into it, I realized that carbon actually was part of the answer to our problems, not simply the bad guy. And so if you look at carbon kind of differently, and that's kind of what the book is about, let's look at the role that carbon plays in our lives, and let's look at the positive roles that it plays. And so the kind of the quick answer is, for anybody who's listening who's a gardener, you know, that dark rich soil that you sink your hands into when you garden, that's carbon, most of it. It's what brings soil to life. It's the food that feeds the microbes and the earthworms and the nematodes and the protozoans, all that kind of stuff, is carbon. It's energy. In the negative sense, it's when we have too much carbon in the atmosphere in the form of carbon dioxide, when we burn too many hydrocarbons, oil, gas, it becomes pollutant. But on the other side of it, it's essential to growing food, to feeding those microbes, to the animals that run around on the land. So in the book, I try to make that distinction. I show that carbon is kind of the link between all these different good activities, and then how we look at carbon as a, you know, as a species, as a concern, as an opportunity, is the key here.
In the prologue of your new book, you lay out some basics of carbon farming. You cite a paper by Scher et al. That says, quote, "Globally, soils contain about three times the amount of carbon that's stored in the vegetation and twice the amount stored in the atmosphere. Since two-thirds of the Earth's land mass is grassland, additional CO2 storage in the soil via better management practices, even on a small scale, could have a huge impact. Grasslands are also home to 2 billion people who depend on livestock, an important source of food and wealth and culture to much of the Earth's human population. Both these animals and their human stewards could be mobilized for carbon action, unquote. So carbon stays in the ground in a pretty stable state for hundreds of thousands of years, providing its many functions for the life that grows out of it. And this is the target of carbon farming, which I'd love for you to elaborate on. And these principles apply to vegetable farming and permaculture too, right?
Oh, yeah, sure. The quick answer is yes, because it's all carbon, fundamentally. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's all the same stuff. But let me kind of back up a little bit and talk about the carbon sink of soils. And sink is a good term, you know, to do that, we need to back up even a little bit farther and talk about the carbon cycle, which is the great flow of carbon around the planet. And, you know, carbon goes up in the atmosphere as carbon dioxide. It comes down through photosynthesis into plants. So plants need carbon dioxide to live. Photosynthesis breaks the C of the CO2, which is carbon, off from the O2, which is oxygen. The oxygen goes back out, and that's good for us. The C, carbon, ends up in a lot of different places in a plant, but a bunch of it goes into the soil through roots. And that's why we're talking about carbon sequestration. Sequestration means, you know, to hide, to store in somewhere. In this case, we're trying to sequester the C in the atmosphere of carbon dioxide in the soils. And one of the reasons I wrote the book is a lot of attention has been paid to trees, forests over the years. You know, there's been a lot of work on activism part and governments and treaties and things, trying to figure out how to protect forests, how to keep them healthy, how to keep from getting them cut down. And forests soak up a lot of carbon dioxide, you know, through photosynthesis, and they store them in the wood or in the roots or in the soils. And when I first started looking into this, I read somewhere a soil scientist said, "That's great. However, you can store a lot more carbon in the soil than in trees." And also, trees have the habit, unfortunately, of dying. You know, they they can be cut down. They can be they die of old age, or they burn up. Out here in the West, I'm in New Mexico. The West has had a lot of big forest fires the last 4 or 5 years. So a lot of that carbon that's stored in trees and leaves and tree trunks and branches can burn up, and all that carbon goes back up into the atmosphere. Soils, however, don't die, right? I mean, the soils are there under the ground. If they are left undisturbed, you know, I guess a wild condition in a sense, not plowed, not turned over, not eroded, that carbon can be stored for a long, long time. And so to answer your question, is what are the practices, what can we do to help increase carbon storage in soils and then leave them undisturbed or relatively undisturbed so that carbon doesn't leak back into the atmosphere? So ranches out here where I live, we work with some very progressive-minded ranchers who manage their livestock in a way that mimics natural grazing behavior, wild grazers. They move their cows around. The cows graze and go. They don't stay. They don't linger. They don't overgraze. And when they do that, there's a very nice relationship between grass and grazers, whether the grazer is domestic or wild. And grass can do well. It can grow. It needs a little bit of disturbance. That old grass gets eaten off. The roots grow, and you can store more carbon. So these ranchers, through their behavior with their livestock, can actually enhance the grasslands, storing more carbon. And as you said, there's so many grasslands around the world. That's the largest terrestrial form of land, grasslands, the potential to store more carbon in soils is actually pretty large. The question is, of course, how do you do it? And ultimately, we can talk about this later, how to make it economic so that ranchers and other folks want to do it.
I'm wondering how this ties into, or if you could explain the 2% that you were talking about in your book, 2% of grassland could absorb all the excess carbon in the atmosphere inside of a decade. Like, is this really feasible? And do you think it has real world potential globally?
Yeah, that's a quote from someone who said, boy, we can soak up a lot of CO2 with only 2%. It's not quite as good as that. What I meant, you can soak up a lot. But the 2% refers to the carbon content of soils. And this was, when I first started looking into this, I didn't realize that most soils have, of 100% of the soil sample, 4 to 5 to 6 to 7% can be carbon. And that's good. In your garden, for example, if you're a gardener and you add a lot of compost and you really work the soil over, that carbon content can get up to, 8%, 9%, 10%. So my point was that if we could increase the carbon content of soils planet-wide by 2%, only 2%, let's say from 2% to 4%, double it, essentially, that's a lot of carbon, and that's a lot of carbon sequestration as a consequence. I don't know if it can soak up all the excess CO2, as that guy said, but it could potentially soak up a lot. So that's all we have to do. We just have to raise the carbon content of the soil from, let's say, 2% or 3% to 4% or 5%. And that has a big, big, big benefit, both for the climate, because it soaks up CO2, and all these great collateral effects, like, plants like carbon dioxide. They grow. If their roots go deeper, we store more carbon. The soil, when it's carbonized, has more micro pores and can store more water, so that the water holding capacity goes up. And out here where it's dry, we want more water in the soil. So it has all these kind of great benefits besides just the climate effect. Lots of reasons why we want to recarbonize our soils. Mm. And we could probably talk about why, what's happened historically, because a lot of these soils, especially out here, have been degraded, eroded, and lost a lot of their carbon content as a consequence.
Right. I mean, looking back at, since farming has been around, we've seen different civilizations running into this issue of soil erosion and topsoil depletion. When we think of, 24 billion tons of Earth's topsoil erode each year, and we clearly have a dominant culture that is systematically squandering it. And so we kind of see where the issues have been with eroding it, over-tilling. And tilling, that's actually another topic I wanted to bring up. There has been some debate about no-till farming, and I was wondering if you could explain the process and the benefits of no-till and how this blends in with land health, soil health, and carbon.
Sure. And this was a kind of a steep learning curve for me, because I work with ranchers, but I don't know much about farming. And so when I first started looking into this, I was surprised to learn how much damage plowing does. Plowing, for your listeners, you think of farming, you think of plowing, right? You think of turning the soil over. There's a famous hieroglyph of a plow on an Egyptian temple wall. It's 5,000 years old. We've been plowing a long time. Well, it turns out when you plow, when you turn soil over, exposing the microorganisms, all those nematodes and protozoas, all that great stuff in the soil, the wind, the sun, the heat, the air kills them. They just die. And including the fungi, the mycorrhizal fungi, which are the key ingredient to carbon sequestration. They're the fungi that kind of attaches themselves to the roots of plants and barter the carbon with the soil, so that they're kind of the middlemen between the soil and the plant, and the water and the carbon and the minerals, that kind of all go back and forth through the fungi. Well, plowing rips them up. It just kills them. And that's how we lose fertility in the soil. We lose a lot of biological life. And then we have to replace it with chemicals, chemical fertilizers, And then we end up with a chemical system, not a biological system, which is what most of our agriculture is today. It's a chemical-based food system. So to not plow, to think of an alternative to plowing, a group of folks came up with what's called no-till agriculture. What they do is that they use a thin drill, what's called a chisel drill, that cuts a very thin slice through the soil and drops a seed down without having to turn the soil over. And it's controversial in the sense that one of the benefits of plowing, of course, is it eliminates weeds, right? Mm. You turn it over the soil and the weeds die. Well, no-till doesn't do that. So the weeds do grow. The response for a lot of no-till farmers is to spray herbicide, right, to kill the weeds. We don't like that. We don't want that. We don't want any herbicides, pesticides, anything ending in the word side, which means to kill. So in the book, I profile an organic no-till process that's come out of the Rodale Institute in Pennsylvania, where they use a cover crop. And the cover crop is, you know, something that just grows on the ground. It can be a cash crop, or it can be some kind of vegetative cover that just keeps it from being bare soil. And they drill through that, and that keeps the weeds down. Mm. It's a little bit complicated, but basically there's a way to keep the weeds down and do no-till and grow food and store carbon. And they've done the measurements, and there are farmers out there doing this successfully. And it's kind of like the holy grail of agriculture is how to do no-till organically. It's not being done by a lot of folks yet. The word's just kind of getting out right now. But it is a very successful way of producing food and storing carbon. It keeps that ground covered. And when you keep ground covered, the moisture stays there. The animals are happy. The microcritters are happy. All these kind of cool things. And you don't spray any herbicide on it. So it's kind of a neat deal. But it's a pretty radical paradigm shift for agriculture. You know, we're not plowing. We're not turning land over. We're not leaving a lot of bare soil. And we're not spraying herbicides and pesticides. And how radical is that? I mean, that's pretty different. And it's a nature-based way of looking at food production. It's not wild, but it's using natural principles. It's using way nature would grow plants, you know, with microbes in the soil and carbon. And it's just producing food that we can eat.
And when we think about the cover crop, in no-till, is the grass the cover crop in the carbon ranching method?
Yeah. Well, it can be a number of different things. And so in the book, I profile an Australian farmer, rancher named Colin Seiss. And I went down to visit him. He does a very interesting, very unusual, and quite radical thing. He is a sheep farmer, and he drills no-till drills a crop, in this case an oat crop, in the winter, so it grows up through the pasture. So he calls it pasture cropping. So he's got oats coming up through the pasture. He harvests the oats, and then he turns the sheep out on the pasture. So it's an annual and a perennial system together. As he likes to put it, you know, nature likes weeds and plants together, so why do we fight it all the time? And so in this case, he uses an annual crop, an oat crop, and the perennial pasture together. So he's producing two sources of food, oats, which he feeds to his sheep, and then sheep themselves, which he shaves for wool. It's not a meat farm. But what's really amazing about this is that symbiotic relationship between the annual plants and the perennial plants creates this huge diversity of life underground. Nature really likes it. So the microbes like it. Topsoil gets built quickly. Carbon gets sequestered. Water gets stored. I mean, all these kind of wonderful things all happen by using nature's ideas, nature's principles of how annuals and perennial plants should go together. He's just doing it in kind of an agricultural context. But if you go out on his ranch, it's beautiful to look at. You know, he's got grass and trees and water stretching to the horizon. And it's a way to get through drought. He's got more water in the soil. He's got two crops. I mean, it's really an interesting system. Australia is ahead of us in some respects in these kind of ideas. Pasture cropping has taken off in Australia, not so much here in America, where pasture cropping is still so radical, I guess, that it's not widely practiced yet.
Usually when you think of cattle farming or sheep, you kind of think of these large industrial, very destructive farms. And you see the issues that come from meat consumption, or, you know, the voracious appetite of the American meat eater and the rising demand for beef from other countries that were not traditionally heavy beef consumers, you know, China and India. And so I have a difficult time seeing sustainable grazing at a scale commensurate with the demand. My view is that meat consumption must be reduced drastically here and abroad. The methane, the catastrophic feedback loops that's causing. Like, I feel an urgency to halt the release of more gases and sequester them in any way possible. So in your view, do the positive effects of grazing animals merit the added methane?
Yeah. Well, there's there's a lot of parts to that question. Mm-hmm. Let me put the methane question aside just for a sec. Mm-hmm. and go back to kind of the nature-based grazing model versus the industrial livestock model. And I think this gets lost a little bit in that kind of question about cows as, you know, as part of our agricultural system. You know, most beef today is produced in feedlots with industrially raised corn, a lot of fossil fuel use, water use, all that kind of stuff. And it's hard to defend that system. It's very resource intensive. If you've ever been to a feedlot and seen the cows standing around in the manure, I mean, it's really it's shocking and disturbing. Mm-hmm. There's kind of no way to justify it except the way the industry does, which is that it produces a lot of beef cheaply. And mm-hmm. so, you know, got to feed a lot of people, here's a lot of beef. You know, this ground has been covered well by Michael Pollan and Barbara Kingsolver and lots of other folks. The alternate model, and getting to your question about whether we can do this at scale, is the grass-based model, which most of the ranchers that we know use, which is the animals are on grass their entire lives, which is how exactly nature wants them to be. And nature doesn't want them eating corn byproducts. They can't process grain. They have to inject them with all these chemicals and stuff to keep them from dying. But on grass, they're happy. That's what cows are supposed to do. They're grass-eating animals. So the ranches we work with generally operate in a grass-based system, you know, grass-fed beef, local. And also, it's important to remember, there's an old saying in organic agriculture about nature never farms with animals, meaning that nature likes grazing animals in grass systems. And so it doesn't have to be cows, but anything that eats grass, pronghorns, bison, you know, all kinds of other animals. There's a very strong mutual relationship between grazers and grass. Cows, because they're domesticated, can stand in as proxies for those wild grazers, and they can be managed in such a way to mimic that wild grazing behavior. So they actually can be good for grasslands. I mean, these grasslands want to be grazed. I mean, that's kind of how they evolved. In North America, our grasslands have been around for 66 million years, at least, and they've had something grazing on them. So that's important, kind of a baseline here, is that it's not, you know, no cows versus cows overgrazing. Grazers have a role on grasslands. If we're going to have grasslands, which we should, we've got to think about how to graze them, and if you're going to use cows, use them in a manner that mimics natural grazing behavior. So that's the first step. Now, can we grass-fed beef at scale? globally to feed the intense beef demand? Probably not. I'm with you. I think we eat too much beef as a species, and that is rising. Historically, prehistorically, we just didn't eat that much meat, you know, as we do today. But it's important to say that if we are going to eat meat, then ask questions about where that meat is from. Is it from a feedlot? Is it from a grass-based ranch? Is it from a ranch that's doing kind of the right things for the carbon and, mm-hmm. and the planet? Cows produce methane. It's what they do. They belch. they eat. They belch. So methane, the thing about, a couple of things about methane, and this always pops up in these discussions. Methane is produced a number of different places on Earth. One of the largest methane producers is rice paddies. In fact, I've seen competing figures, but some folks feel that rice paddies produce more methane than livestock do. And yet I haven't seen anybody say that we need to stop eating rice. So, you know, this becomes a little bit of a political issue, I think, about where does the methane come from. Wetlands produce a lot of methane, peat bogs, wetlands. And the other thing about methane, it's important to realize that in the great carbon cycle, you know, the carbon and greenhouse gases kind of cycling around the planet, when we dig up buried carbon in the form of coal and other kinds of fossil fuels and burn it, so we dig up this carbon that's been buried, sequestered for 300 million years and burn it, we add carbon to the carbon cycle. Well, that's how we're getting in trouble. We're adding more carbon to what already exists, and now we're adding too much of it. When cows exhale methane or, you know, even wetlands, that kind of stuff, it's part of the cycle. It's already there. It's cycling around. Cows eat whatever and they belch, and that methane kind of goes round and round. We're adding to the methane load, but it's still part of that great cycle. It's the digging up and burning of new carbon is the problem. And that tends to get lost in the debate here, is we've got to stop adding new greenhouse gases, carbon, to the atmosphere, and I think worry less about the cycling of stuff that's already here.
Yeah, I mean, when I think about the grasslands and using cows, you know, using cattle to mimic the ancient symbiotic relationship between ruminants and grasslands, I see that they are a large benefit. But 2/3 of the world is currently grasslands, and I wonder how much of that is native and how much has been deforested. A case study that you write about takes place at a ranch in Marin, and as a native Californian myself, I feel the absence of the once mighty coastal redwood forest. So I'm wondering, do you support returning the deforested areas that are not originally grassland to their previous ecosystems, or should they first become healthy as grasslands, and once soil has been restored, we can transition them over time back to forest? But what's your take on this?
Well, that's a good question. And in California in particular, I don't know the ecology over there as well as I should. I know that there's been a lot of change in the ecology of California. Most of the grasslands are annual grass systems, not perennial. And that came in with the Spanish and kind of the early settlers and that sort of stuff. So that, I know the grass systems there have changed rather dramatically. I don't know about coastal a coastal forest, redwood forest. First and foremost, I would agree with the second part. You know, we need to get these lands functioning. Out here where I am, we have a lot of degraded land, a lot of poorly functioning landscapes, and you can't really start talking about the full, complete ecological biota without having function at kind of a basic level, meaning that the water cycle works, the carbon cycle works, there's some kind of cover on the ground to keep the rain from washing everything away. And I write a little bit in the book about getting function up and running before we start talking about what we do with these landscapes. And there's different ways. So we've been involved a lot in creek restoration. There's two chapters in the book about ecological restoration, wetlands in one and creeks in the other. And how do you get these degraded water systems healthy again so they can support whatever, wildlife, you know, cows, trees, that kind of stuff. The other question, which I don't know much about, especially in California, is, you know, how our changing climate is going to be changing ecologies. You know, out here,
out here, the forest ecologists I talk to are doubtful about the long-term viability of our kind of big ponderosa forests. And we have hotter and drier conditions setting in. We have bigger fires. They're seeing stands of forest turn into shrublands as a consequence of these big fires. And so what, in the, this is a, as much about philosophy as it is about ecology, is like what in the era of climate change is natural, I guess. Mm-hmm. What, you know, what was here historically, you know, in California, we love the oaks. Can they deal with drought? You know, can they deal with changing conditions? Are we going to be seeing different kinds of drought tolerant species move in? You know, when fire comes sweeping through here, aspens, for example, are really having a hard time coming back. Traditionally, they would, but our conditions have changed here that we don't see many seedlings, many young aspen or young spruce growing. And the forest ecologists say this is entirely consistent with hotter and drier conditions that are setting up here. And so then you ask, you know, philosophical questions about what do we do? You know, do we spend a lot of time and money trying to recreate a system that may not be viable in the long run? Or do you let nature kind of do its thing? Do you spend more time working on grasslands? I mean, it's these are complicated questions. I'm glad you're asking them. And I think if anybody's got some bright ideas, it should holler up.
Speaking about the Southwest, some climatologists are saying the Southwest is now in permanent drought. And I wonder if deforestation and overgrazing are causes, and I suspect they are. So do you see reviving grasslands as an endpoint or a transition to some other ecosystem that involves trees? And what role does the water shortage have in this grassland restoration?
Yeah, good questions. A friend of mine who's a forest ecologist told me a couple of years ago that if you love forests, your heart's going to be broken. But if you love grasses, the future for grasslands out here is pretty bright because just the way the systems are. Hotter temperatures stress trees. They've done a lot of research on this, just kind of the way that heat affects trees. It's not just a lack of water. It's actually rising temperatures are tough on trees. It's just the way they process and diffuse heat that they gather, that kind of stuff. And so as heat stress rises on trees, you see more mortality, and not just fires, but just kind of trees, you know, dealing with it. Grasses respond differently. They don't handle heat stress better, I guess. That was his point, that you're going to see kind of conversion over time away from kind of large stands of forest to larger stands of shrubs and grasses. Is that a good thing? I don't know. You know, I don't know. What can we do about it? Well, we'd love to turn down greenhouse gas emissions and try to keep this process from going any further. If we are concerned about the ecology of this landscape and more particularly living here, you know, can we live here in a hotter and drier conditions? What do we do? Grasslands can erode quickly, meaning if they're not managed properly, if they're overgrazed, they can erode to these big storms pretty quickly. There are things we can do about that, particularly about better grass management, that kind of stuff. You know, these are tough questions. A lot of folks kind of don't want to think about them. They just kind of look the other way and say, you know, it's going to be okay. It's going to rain again. You know, actually, we've had some good rains this summer here. Kind of a little bit of the talk of drought has sort of drifted away. You know, people's memories seem to be kind of short. And we haven't had any big fires here this summer as we expected, so it's knock on wood. So it's kind of hard balancing all of these concerns, what scientists say, long-term trends with kind of short-term needs, and finding the right path forward. Thank you.
stars were shining bright. Storm come up and the trees come down. Tell you boys I was waterbound. Waterbound on a stranger's shore. River rise into my door. Carried my home to the field below. A waterbound, nowhere to go. Dime in my nation sack. I'm waterbound and I can't get back. Say my name and don't forget. The water still ain't got me yet. Nothing but I'm bound to roam. Waterbound and I can't get home.
We're here with Courtney White, and we're talking about one of the planet's most important and overlooked carbon sinks, the grasslands. So Courtney, could you put us on the ground level of a grassland restoration site? What does it look like? Who's doing what?
Sure. And I think the best way to do that is to tell the story that I do in the book of Tom Sidwell, who is probably the best drought manager, one of the best cattle managers I know here in New Mexico. And he bought a ranch, he and his wife bought a ranch in 2003 out east in New Mexico, highly degraded, a lot of eroded gullies and kind of poor water cycle, a lot of bare ground, pretty classic worn out landscape here, hard used, overgrazed, and then eventually abandoned. So Tom bought it and did what he has done before, which is really turn it around ecologically. He used different tools, not just cows, but what he did with the cows was he took the ranch, which is 7,000 acres, in six paddocks, so six pastures. He divided it up into smaller units, smaller paddocks, and he moves his cows through very rapidly, so they don't stay anywhere more than a couple days, mimicking again that natural behavior of wild grazers who would eat and go. In the process of moving across a landscape, they turn up the soil, they break that capped soil so that seeds can get into the ground, they defecate, they eat the old grass, which stimulates grass growth, and then they leave. And they don't come back for a year or more, depending on what he's doing. So, and again, it's just like a herd of bison kind of moving through, you know, big disturbance for a short period of time, kind of stirring things up, giving a big pulse of energy to the land, to the soil, to the plants. Grasslands, if they just sort of sit there over time, they don't have fire, they don't have some kind of grazing behavior, they turn gray. They aren't green, they're gray. They oxidize in the sun, and they die eventually. So this is what he's doing. He's mimicking the behavior of wild animals that would graze and go. He doesn't come back for a year in any particular paddock. And that gives the plants a lot of rest and rain and they grow and they proliferate and they spread. And you can see the contrast between his ranch and his neighbor's ranch, which continues the old style of grazing. So just simply using herbivory, the tool of herbivory, grazing animals, carefully, and he's watching everything, and he's monitoring stuff, and he can reinvigorate the grasslands on his ranch, and that's exactly what he's done. And he's got all the data to show more grass, more plants, more. The spring near his house is producing more water. He also has spent a lot of time removing invasive trees, junipers, and pinons in particular, that kind of moved in mesquite, and kind of restoring what were originally grasslands out there. He's in pretty dry country. As a function of poor land management, trees will move in and they compete with grass for water and other resources. So he actually removed a bunch of woody vegetation on his ranch, and the grasslands came back and the water cycle worked. And I know he's sequestering more carbon than he was when he got started. Anyway, so he's an active land manager. He's holistic. He's looking at ecological function. He's doing all the things that need to be done to restore health, land health, water cycle, mineral cycle. And by the way, he's a cattle rancher. Mm. You know, he produces grass-fed beef. He sells it and direct markets it to folks. The cow is his tool, but it's also his economic engine for the ranch, because otherwise he can't afford to do this work. So it's a neat relationship. It's grassland country. It was degraded. He brought it back. He's profitable, and he's producing food. Hmm. Pretty neat.
It's amazing, and it reminds me of this bridge that you talk about, bridging that gap between ranchers, conservationists, public land managers, scientists, environmentalists, and so forth, you know, bringing these people together, opening these doors for a common cause to work towards this, you know, coming from different avenues. And I was wondering, what other experiences have you had where you've seen perhaps different groups of people coming together to work towards environmental renewal?
So, working together, we call it the radical center. And this was a term that was invented by a rancher back in the 90s to describe a sort of a collaborative effort among diverse groups who come together to solve problems pragmatically. And it's radical because folks, instead of fighting, which is what we do out here, we fight with each other, they're trying to find common ground, common answers to problems. And it's in the center because it is politically centrist, meaning that we don't kind of bunker down in our Republican versus Democratic thing, or environmentalists versus ranchers, or urban versus rural. It's in the middle. It's literally, you kind of walk out of these trenches, meet in the center, and talk about stuff. And I found that to be very true when folks who are otherwise very politically different get together and talk about grass, water, food. I mean, food is a fabulous way to bring people together. Everybody eats. Everybody likes to talk about food. Then all these political differences melt away. I mean, there's still some push-button issues. Climate change is still kind of a hot-button issue for some folks in the West. But if you talk about building carbon in soils, about fixing creeks, about animals, about food, everybody starts talking the same language, and it's really cool to see, and really quite exciting. And I've seen it over and over again. When you talk about land, when you talk about the dirt under your feet, if you talk about grass, water, people get it, and they want to do something about it. And the tools that can fix things are non-political. You know, there's fixing creeks is not a political issue. Cattle generally aren't. They're political for some folks on both sides of this. But if you just talk about making grasslands healthier, however we do it, folks get it and can come together. I wish, and this is the challenge we face, So we can scale up the radical center to our political system, which is so totally dysfunctional, as you know. haven't quite figured out how to do that yet, but I figure if ranchers and environmentalists can talk to each other, mm-hmm. and they do now, they didn't mm-hmm. when we got started back in the 90s, they do now. Maybe there's hope for a political system. I don't know.
We all are really looking for the same goals of food and security, and we need the environment to thrive in order to have both of those things. When we work together, we can get a lot right. more done than if we spend our time fighting each other. We waste a lot of vital energy doing that. If you could talk a bit about the economics of how to support people in doing this type of work, like you were talking about the rancher in East New Mexico, because obviously if more people could get paid or if more people could be financially supported while doing restoration work, we'd probably have a lot more people being able and wanting right. to do the restoration work.
Right. Yeah, this is sort of the $64,000 question. How do we take the toolbox? And mm-hmm. The toolbox has been well developed. And how do we make it work economically and at scale at some point? Because we're still talking about kind of radical, marginal stuff. You know, change happens on the edges first and then moves inwards towards the center. And that's what we're seeing. The quick answer is, for someone like Tom Sidwell, it works economically as an added value, so that he adds value to his products, in this case beef, grass-fed, you know, carbon-friendly, those kinds of things, that he's able to raise the price of the products. People are willing to pay for it, and he stays in business. Ultimately, is how do we pay landowners, somehow compensate them for sequestering carbon in soils at a scale, meaning just let's say you were a landowner and I said to you, hey, if you double the carbon content in your soil in 10 years, I'll give you $150,000. I don't know, whatever, mm-hmm. $200,000. Here's a contract. It's easy to measure. Carbon's easy to measure. And you have benchmarks, and you have to have some wiggle room in case there's a drought or something. But basically, 10 years later, you say, look, I did it. Here's my money. Society's paying me, compensating me mm-hmm. for doing this stuff that's good for the land, it's good for the water, it's good for the climate. You're paying me directly somehow. And what's cool about this is that there's nothing that increases soil carbon that degrades the land. It's all regenerative. Mm. It's all, and then I let you decide how you do it. So I just tell you, if you double the carbon content of your soil, I'll pay you. You figure out how to do it, whether you do it with wild animals, cows, sheep, you know, no-till, however you do it. Mm-hmm. To increase the carbon content of your soil, because you can't increase carbon and degrade the land. You just can't. This is what's neat about carbon. You can only increase carbon with practices that are good for the land, that are healthy, you know, increase microbial life, increase the water cycle, that kind of stuff. But then you decide, well, I want to do it this way, you know, with this animal or that practice or whatever, fixed creeks. And I come back and we measure it and you say, hey, you're doing a great job. Here's your first payment, you know, that kind of thing. Now, that's my fantasy. That's my magic wand. We'd wave across the land and say, hey, boy, if we could just pay people somehow to mm-hmm. do this work, all this cool stuff would happen. Are we there yet? No. You know, for me, to be frank with you, a carbon tax would be a great way to create a pool of money, you know, and pull down the emissions side of this, make it more expensive to burn fossil fuels, and create a pot of money that would pay landowners to increase carbon in the soil. Sounds like a win-win to me. What are the chances of that passing politically in this country? Zero. But at least it's sort of fun to think about.
Mm-hmm. And is there a limit to how much carbon you can store in soil?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I thought so until I started talking to a couple agroecologists, and one in particular who's in the book, Jeffrey Creek, who managed who's the kind of carbon guy at an olive farm in California near Petaluma,
And what he did, he did a lot of composting. He was kind of in charge of the whole compost program, restoration work, all this kind of stuff, sheep grazing in the, and he raised the carbon content from 2% to 4%. And that what he that that's what he thought was historically the carbon levels out there, 4% of the soil. But he decided to keep going. And he told me in an interview that there is nothing in nature that says you can't have more carbon. I mean, there's no negative impact. You know, things don't suddenly tip over and everything kind of goes bad. As long as the system continues to be productive, you know, you don't have too much nitrogen or something, you can keep adding carbon to the soils. He was aiming for 5%, 6%. On the farm, I mean, that was his goal. There was no ecological reason to not to try, and I think that's really, really pretty cool. The other thing, real quickly, is about degraded lands, and we have a lot of them out here. Is that, you know, they have lost their carbon, a lot of them. It's kind of like a glass full of water. We've kind of poured out half the water, meaning we poured out half the carbon in these lands, and so they're waiting, ready to be filled back up. I mean, that's the only silver lining to the degraded land that we have out here, is that it can be recarbonized if we manage it properly. It's tricky in a drought. The carbon cycle goes more slowly. Plants don't grow as well when it doesn't rain, so things slow down. But nevertheless, this land is ready to be filled back up again with carbon and all the great things that flow from it, whether it's for wildlife or for domesticated animals or for creeks. You know, I have a chapter in the book about beaver. Beaver are nature's carbon engineers, and we did a really terrible thing by decimating the beaver population in North America historically. They're coming back, but it's slow. But beavers, man, they do great stuff for the land, for the water, and the soils behind those beaver dams, full of carbon. It's a neat deal. So it's not about, it's not just about farming and ranching and cows. It's about sort of a holistic vision of natural systems, the way nature does stuff. Nature likes carbon, and soils wants to put it there. We just have to do the things that help it along.
And whether somebody has a backyard or a larger piece of land or even a community garden, what are some first steps people can take to start capturing carbon in their soil?
Right. Yeah. The question being, what can I do? What can we do? So kind of two answers to that. Yeah, if you manage land, whether it's a large piece of land or a very small backyard plot, there's things you can do. There's a profile in the book about two young men who turned their backyard in Massachusetts into this amazing food forest. They took a bare, wasted tenth of an acre backyard, and they through a lot of hard work, created a perennial forest, including banana trees on the driveways. Anyway, so they, you know, think about the carbon content of that. I mean, that's huge. In fact, one of them is writing a book right now on carbon farming in urban contexts. So you can manage land to increase soil carbon. The other thing is, quickly, that your listeners can't see, but the cover of the book is a map, and it's a map that we drew some years ago, kind of this idealized carbon landscape. Everything I could think of, whether it was birding or hiking or farming or ranching or creeks being fixed, whatever, wildlife. And the point was that everybody is on the map, whether you live in a city, whether you live in the country, whether you are a biologist or a hiker or whatever. Carbon is a part of your life. And that's kind of the point of the book, is that we don't realize that. We don't know it until we start thinking about it. How does carbon affect my life? What can I do about it? And that's what the book is about, kind of all these different ways of looking at carbon landscapes, not just through food and ranching, but about wetlands and art. There's a whole chapter kind of thinking about land artistically, rooftop farming, all kinds of stuff. We can do things directly to manage carbon in our lives, but we also think about the indirect ways that we can influence things. Eating, for example, we're all eaters, Where does our food come from? Does it come from a healthy landscape, carbon-friendly landscape? Does it come from a degraded landscape, a feedlot, you know, that kind of stuff? And I just generally try to raise sort of the carbon consciousness of the readers. Just, you know, think about these things differently, find out where you are on the map, see what you can do to improve our situation, and go for it.
Right. And you know, it's a wonderful thing to be able to build soil, whether that's through a small perennial and annual garden or a larger space where we're protecting the soil with cover crops and helping to fix the water systems and whatnot. Thank you for providing us with the science and the vision. And now it's everyone else's job to make it happen. And whether that's, you know, a small backyard plot, a rooftop garden, or a larger piece of land, it's possible. And these tools have been around for a long time. Right. And I'm really appreciative to have the science to understand it on a deeper level. So yeah, it's really wonderful work you're doing. And thank you so much, Courtney, for coming on today.
Well, thank you for the opportunity. I really appreciate it.
And is there anything that you'd like to add on to the interview?
I just want to make sure I identify the publisher of the book, Chelsea Green, which has a lot of really good books, titles that they publish. It's an honor for me to be included in their family. And I think if listeners are not familiar with Chelsea Green, check them out. They publish all kinds of stuff on gardening and sustainability and food and water and all that kind of stuff. So I would just encourage folks to check them out.
And do you have a website that our listeners could go to?
I do. My website is called awestthatworks.com. Awestthatworks.com. All one word. It's where I have a lot of other writing. I had a book published a couple of years ago, and parts of that are on there. And got another book coming out next year. People can go check it out.
Thank you for listening to Unlearn and Rewild. I'd also like to thank our producer, March Young. Our music selection today was by Dirk Powell. And our theme song was, of course, by the late and great Kate Wolf.
Tall western cedar, drifting on the wind, through the mountains like a river.